Part 2. The Shoulder Shrug. Featuring a girl made of darkness, the joy of cigarettes, a town walker, some dead letters, Hitler's birthday, 100% pure German sweat, the gates of thievery, and a book of fire. A girl made of darkness. Some statistical information. First stolen book, January 13th, 1939. Second stolen book, April 20th, 1940. Duration between said stolen books, 463 days. If you were being flippant about it, you'd say that all it took was a little bit of fire, really, and some human shouting to go with it. You'd say that was all Liesel Memminger needed to apprehend her second stolen book, even if it smoked in her hands, even if it lit her ribs. The problem, however, is this. This is no time to be flippant. It's no time to be half-watching, turning around or checking the stove, because when the book thief stole her second book, not only were there many factors involved in her hunger to do so, but the act of stealing it triggered the crux of what was to come. It would provide her with a venue for continued book thievery. It would inspire Hans Hubermann to come up with a plan to help the Jewish fist fighter. And it would show me, once again, that one opportunity leads directly to another, just as risk leads to more risk, life to more life, and death to more death. In a way, it was destiny. You see, people may tell you that Nazi Germany was built on anti-Semitism, a somewhat overzealous leader, and a nation of hate-fed bigots, but it would all have come to nothing had the Germans not loved one particular activity. To burn. The Germans loved to burn things. Shops, synagogues, Reichstags, houses, personal items, slain people, and of course, books. They enjoyed a good book burning, all right, which gave people who were partial to books the opportunity to get their hands on certain publications that they otherwise wouldn't have. One person who was that way inclined, as we know, was a thin-boned girl named Liesel Memminger. She may have waited 463 days, but it was worth it. At the end of an afternoon that had contained much excitement, much beautiful evil, one blood-soaked ankle and a slap from a trusted hand, Liesel Memminger attained her second success story. The Shoulder Shrug. It was a blue book with red writing engraved on the cover, and there was a small picture of a cuckoo bird under the title, also red. When she looked back, Liesel was not ashamed to have stolen it. On the contrary, it was pride that more resembled that small pool of felt something in her stomach. And it was anger and dark hatred that had fueled her desire to steal it. In fact, on April the 20th, the Führer's birthday, when she snatched that book from beneath a steaming heap of ashes, Liesel was a girl made of darkness. The question, of course, should be why. What was there to be angry about? What had happened in the past 4 or 5 months to culminate in such a feeling? In short, the answer travelled from Himmel Street, to the Führer, to the unfindable location of her real mother, and back again. Like most misery, it started with apparent happiness. The Joy of Cigarettes. Toward the end of 1939, Liesel had settled into life in Malking pretty well. She still had nightmares about her brother and missed her mother, but there were comforts now, too. She loved her papa, Hans Hubermann, and even her foster mother, despite the abusages and verbal assaults. She loved and hated her best friend, Rudi Steiner, which was perfectly normal. And she loved the fact that despite her failure in the classroom, her reading and writing were definitely improving and would soon be on the verge of something respectable. All of this resulted in at least some form of contentment and would soon be built upon to approach the concept of being happy. The keys to happiness. 1. Finishing the Gravedigger's Handbook. 2. Escaping the ire of Sister Maria. 3. receiving 2 books for Christmas. December the 17th. She remembered the date well, as it was exactly a week before Christmas. As usual, her nightly nightmare interrupted her sleep, and she was woken by Hans Hubermann. His hand held the sweaty fabric of her pajamas. "The train," he whispered. Liesl confirmed. "The train." She gulped the air until she was ready, and they began reading from the 11th chapter of the Grave Digger's Handbook. Just past 3 o'clock they finished it, and only the final chapter, Respecting the Graveyard, remained. Papa, his silver eyes swollen in their tiredness, and his face awash with whiskers, shut the book and expected the leftovers of his sleep. He didn't get them. The light was out for barely a minute when Liesl spoke to him across the dark. "Papa." He made only a noise somewhere in his throat.
"Are you awake, Papa?"
"Yeah." Up on one elbow.
"Can we finish the book, please?"
There was a long breath, the scratchery of hand on whiskers, and then the light. He opened the book and began. Chapter 12. Respecting the Graveyard. They read through the early hours of morning, circling and writing the words she did not comprehend, and turning the pages toward daylight. A few times, Papa nearly slept, succumbing to the itchy fatigue in his eyes and the wilting of his head. Liesl caught him out on each occasion, but she had neither the selflessness to allow him to sleep, nor the hide to be offended. She was a girl with a mountain to climb. Eventually, as the darkness outside began to break up a little, they finished. The last passage looked like this. "We, at the Bayern Cemetery Association, hope that we have informed and entertained you in the workings, safety measures, and duties of grave digging. We wish you every success with your career in the funerary arts, and hope this book has helped in some way." When the book closed, they shared a sideways glance. Papa spoke. "We made it, huh?" Liesl, half wrapped in blanket, studied the black book in her hand and its silver lettering. She nodded, dry-mouthed and early morning hungry. It was one of those moments of perfect tiredness, of having conquered not only the work at hand, but the knight who had blocked the way. Papa stretched with his fists closed and his eyes grinding shut. And it was a morning that didn't dare to be rainy. They each stood and walked to the kitchen, and through the fog and frost of the window, they were able to see the pink bars of light on the snowy banks of Himmel Street's rooftops. "Look at the colors," Papa said. "It's hard not to like a man who not only notices the colors, but speaks them." Liesl still held the book. She gripped it tighter as the snow turned orange. On one of the rooftops, she could see a small boy sitting, looking at the sky. "His name was Werner," she mentioned. The words trotted out, involuntarily. Papa said, "Yes." At school during that time, there had been no more reading tests, but as Liesl slowly gathered confidence, she did pick up a stray textbook before class one morning to see if she could read it without trouble. She could read every word, but she remained stranded at a much slower pace than that of her classmates. It's much easier, she realized, to be on the verge of something than to actually be it. This would still take time. One afternoon, she was tempted to steal a book from the class bookshelf, but frankly the prospect of another corridor Watschen at the hands of Sister Maria was a powerful enough deterrent. On top of that, there was actually no real desire in her to take the books from school. It was most likely the intensity of her November failure that caused this lack of interest, but Liesl wasn't sure. She only knew that it was there. In class, she did not speak. She didn't so much as look the wrong way. As winter set in, she was no longer a victim of Sister Maria's frustrations, preferring to watch as others were marched out to the corridor and given their just rewards. The sound of another student struggling in the hallway was not particularly enjoyable, but the fact that it was someone else was, if not a true comfort, a relief. When school broke up briefly for Weihnachten, Liesel even afforded Sister Maria a Merry Christmas before going on her way. Knowing that the Hubermans were essentially broke, still paying off debts and paying rent quicker than the money could come in, she was not expecting a gift of any sort. Perhaps only some better food. To her surprise, on Christmas Eve, after sitting in church at midnight with Mama, Papa, Hans Jr. and Trudy, she came home to find something wrapped in newspaper under the Christmas tree. "From St. Nicholas," Papa said, but the girl was not fooled. She hugged both her foster parents, with snow still laid across her shoulders. Unfurling the paper, she unwrapped two small books. The first one, Faust the Dog, was written by a man named Matthäus Ottelberg. All told, she would read that book 13 times. On Christmas Eve, she read the first 20 pages at the kitchen table, while Papa and Hans Jr. argued about a thing she did not understand, something called politics. Later, they read some more in bed, adhering to the tradition of circling the words she didn't know and writing them down. Faust the dog also had pictures, lovely curves and ears, and caricatures of a German shepherd with an obscene drooling problem and the ability to talk. The second book was called The Lighthouse, and was written by a woman, Ingrid Rippenstein. That particular book was a little longer, so Liesel was able to get through it only 9 times, her pace increasing ever so slightly by the end of such prolific readings. It was a few days after Christmas that she asked a question regarding the books. They were eating in the kitchen. Looking at the spoonfuls of pea soup entering Mama's mouth, she decided to shift her focus to Papa. "There's something I need to ask." At first, there was nothing.
"And?"
It was Mama, her mouth still half full.
"I just wanted to know how you found the money to buy my books."
A short grin was smiled into Papa's spoon. "You really want to know?"
"Of course."
From his pocket, Papa took what was left of his tobacco ration and began rolling a cigarette, at which Liesel became impatient.
"Are you going to tell me or not?"
Papa laughed. "But I am telling you, child." He completed the production of one cigarette, flipped it on the table, and began on another. "Just like this." That was when Mama finished her soup with a clank, suppressed a cardboard burp, and answered for him.
"That's Saukerl," she said. "Do you know what he did? He rolled up all of his filthy cigarettes, went to the market when it was in town, and traded them with some gypsy."
8 cigarettes per book? Papa shoved one to his mouth in triumph. He lit up and took in the smoke. "Praise the Lord for cigarettes, huh, Mama?" Mama only handed him one of her trademark looks of disgust, followed by the most common ration of her vocabulary. "Saukerl!" Liesel swapped a customary wink with her papa and finished eating her soup. As always, one of her books was next to her. She could not deny that the answer to her question had been more than satisfactory. There were not many people who could say that their education had been paid for with cigarettes. Mama, on the other hand, said that if Hans Huberman was any good at all, he would trade some tobacco for the new dress she was in desperate need of, or some better shoes. "But no," she emptied the words out into the sink, "when it comes to me, you'd rather smoke a whole ration, wouldn't you? Plus some of next door's." A few nights later, however, Hans Huberman came home with a box of eggs. "Sorry, Mama." He placed them on the table. "They were all out of shoes." Mama didn't complain. She even sang to herself while she cooked those eggs to the brink of burndom. It appeared that there was great joy in cigarettes, and it was a happy time in the Huberman household. It ended a few weeks later. The Town Walker. The rot started with the washing, and it rapidly increased. When Liesel accompanied Rosa Huberman on her deliveries across Malking, One of her customers, Ernst Vogel, informed them that he could no longer afford to have his washing and ironing done. "The times," he excused himself. "What can I say? They're getting harder. The war's making things tight." He looked at the girl. "I'm sure you get an allowance for keeping the little one, don't you?" To Liesl's dismay, Mama was speechless. An empty bag was at her side. "Come on, Liesl." It was not said, it was pulled along, rough-handed. Vogel called out from his front step. He was perhaps 5'9", and his greasy scraps of hair swung lifelessly across his forehead. "I'm sorry, Frau Huberman." Liesl waved at him. He waved back. Mama castigated. "Don't wave to that arschloch," she said. "Now hurry up." That night, when Liesl had a bath, Mama scrubbed her especially hard, muttering the whole time about that Vogel Saukerl, and imitating him at 2-minute intervals. "You must get an allowance for the girl." She berated Liesl's naked chest as she scrubbed away. "You're not worth that much, Zalmensch. You're not making me rich, you know." Liesl sat there and took it. Not more than a week after that particular incident, Rosa hauled her into the kitchen. "Right, Liesl." She sat her down at the table. "Since you spend half your time on the street playing soccer, you can make yourself useful out there, for a change." Liesl watched only her own hands. "What is it, Mama?" "From now on, you're going to pick up and deliver the washing for me. Those rich people are less likely to fire us if you're the one standing in front of them. If they ask you where I am, tell them I'm sick. And look sad when you tell them. You're skinny and pale enough to get their pity." "Herr Vogel didn't pity me." "Well," her agitation was obvious, "the others might. So don't argue."
"Yes, Mama."
For a moment, it appeared that her foster mother would comfort her or pat her on the shoulder. "Good girl, Liesl. Good girl. Pat, pat, pat." She did no such thing. Instead, Rosa Huberman stood up, selected a wooden spoon, and held it under Liesl's nose. It was a necessity as far as she was concerned.
"When you're out on that street, you take the bag to each place and you bring it straight home with the money, even though it's next to nothing. No going to Papa if he's actually working for once. No mucking around with that little Saukerl Rudi Steiner. Straight home."
"Yes, Mama."
"And when you hold that bag, you hold it properly. You don't swing it, drop it, crease it, or throw it over your shoulder."
"Yes, Mama."
"Yes, Mama." Rosa Huberman was a great imitator and a fervent one.
"You'd better not, Saumensch. I'll find out if you do. You know that, don't you?"
"Yes, Mama."
Saying those two words was often the best way to survive, as was doing what she was told. And from there, Liesl walked the streets of Mulking from the poor end to the rich, picking up and delivering the washing. At first, it was a solitary job which she never complained about. After all, the very first time she took the sack through town, she turned the corner onto Munich Street, looked both ways, and gave it one enormous swing, a whole revolution, and then checked the contents inside. Thankfully, there were no creases, no wrinkles, just a smile, and a promise never to swing it again. Overall, Liesl enjoyed it. There was no share of the pay, but she was out of the house. And walking the streets without Mama was heaven in itself. No finger-pointing or cursing, no people staring at them as she was sworn at for holding the bag wrong. Nothing but serenity. She came to like the people, too. The Pfaffelhörbers inspecting the clothes and saying, "Ja, ja, sehr gut, sehr gut." Liesl imagined that they did everything twice. Gentle Helena Schmidt, handing the money over with an arthritic curl of the hand. The Weingartners, whose bent-whiskered cat always answered the door with them. Little Goebbels, that's what they called him, after Hitler's right-hand man. And Frau Herrmann, the mayor's wife, standing fluffy-haired and shivery in her enormous cold-aired doorway. Always silent, always alone. No words, not once. Sometimes Rudi came along. "How much money do you have there? he asked one afternoon. It was nearly dark, and they were walking onto Himmel Street past the shop. You've heard about Frau Dilla, haven't you? They say she's got candy hidden somewhere, and for the right price.
Don't even think about it.
Liesl, as always, was gripping the money hard.
It's not so bad for you. You don't have to face my mama.
Rudy shrugged. It was worth a try. In the middle of January, schoolwork turned its attention to letter writing. After learning the basics, each student was to write two letters, one to a friend and one to somebody in another class. Liesl's letter from Rudy went like this.
Dear Zaumensch, are you still as useless at soccer as you were the last time we played? I hope so. That means I can run past you again, just like Jesse Owens at the Olympics.
When Sister Maria found it, she asked him a question, very amiably. Sister Maria's offer.
Do you feel like visiting the corridor, Mr. Steiner?
Needless to say, Rudy answered in the negative, and the paper was torn up and he started again. The second attempt was written to someone named Liesl, and inquired as to what her hobbies might be. At home, while completing a letter for homework, Liesl decided that writing to Rudy or some other Zaukerl was actually ridiculous. It meant nothing. As she wrote in the basement, she spoke over to Papa, who was repainting the wall again. Both he and the paint fumes turned around. Was wusst's? Now this was the roughest form of German a person could speak, but it was spoken with an air of absolute pleasantness.
Yeah, what?
Would I be able to write a letter to Mama?
A pause.
What do you want to write a letter to her for? You have to put up with her every day.
Papa was schmunzeling, a sly smile.
Isn't that bad enough?
Not that, Mama.
She swallowed.
Oh.
Papa returned to the wall and continued painting. Well, I guess so. You could send it to what's-her-name, the one who brought you here and visited those few times from the foster people.
Frau Heinrich.
That's right. Send it to her. Maybe she can send it on to your mother.
Even at the time, he sounded unconvincing, as if he wasn't telling Liesl something. Word of her mother had also been tight-lipped on Frau Heinrich's brief visits. Instead of asking him what was wrong, Liesl began writing immediately, choosing to ignore the sense of foreboding that was quick to accumulate inside her. It took 3 hours and 6 drafts to perfect the letter, telling her mother all about Molking, her papa and his accordion, the strange but true ways of Rudi Steiner, and the exploits of Rosa Huberman. She also explained how proud she was that she could now read and write a little. The next day, she posted it at Frau Diller's with a stamp from the kitchen drawer. And she began to wait. The night she wrote the letter, she overheard a conversation between Hans and Rosa. What's she doing writing to her mother? Mama was saying. Her voice was surprisingly calm and caring. As you can imagine, this worried the girl a great deal. She'd have preferred to hear them arguing. Whispering adults hardly inspired confidence. She asked me, Papa answered, and I couldn't say no. How could I?
Jesus, Mary and Joseph,
again with the whisper.
She should just forget her. Who knows where she is? Who knows what they've done to her?
In bed, Liesl hugged herself tight. She balled herself up. She thought of her mother and repeated Rosa Huberman's questions. Where was she? What had they done to her? And once and for all, who, in actual fact, were they? Dead letters. Flash forward to the basement, September 1943. A 14-year-old girl is writing in a small, dark-covered book. She is bony but strong and has seen many things. Papa sits with the accordion at his feet. He says,
You know, Liesl, I nearly wrote you a reply and signed your mother's name.
He scratches his leg where the plaster used to be. But I couldn't. I couldn't bring myself. Several times, through the remainder of January and the entirety of February 1940, when Liesl searched the mailbox for a reply to her letter. It clearly broke her foster father's heart.
"I'm sorry," he would tell her. "Not today, huh?"
In hindsight, she saw that the whole exercise had been pointless.
Had her mother been in a position to do so, she would have already made contact with the foster care people, or directly with the girl, or the Hubermans. But there had been nothing.
To lend insult to injury, in mid-February, Liesl was given a letter from another ironing customer, the Pfaffelhuevers from Heiderstrasse. The pair of them stood with great tallness in the doorway, giving her a melancholic regard.
"For your mama," the man said, handing her the envelope. "Tell her we're sorry. Tell her we're sorry."
That was not a good night in the Huberman residence. Even when Liesl retreated to the basement to write her fifth letter to her mother, all but the first one yet to be sent, she could hear Rosa swearing and carrying on about those Pfaffelhuever Arschlöcher and that lousy Ernst Vogel.
"Feuer sollen's brunzen für einen Monat," she heard her call out.
Translation?
"They should all piss fire for a month."
Liesl wrote. When her birthday came around, there was no gift. There was no gift because there was no money, and at the time, Papa was out of tobacco.
"I told you," Mama pointed a finger at him, "I told you not to give her both books at Christmas, but no, did you listen? Of course not."
"I know." He turned quietly to the girl. "I'm sorry, Liesl, we just can't afford it."
Liesl didn't mind. She didn't whine or moan or stamp her feet. She simply swallowed the disappointment and decided on one calculated risk, a present from herself. She would gather all of the accrued letters to her mother, stuff them into one envelope, and use just a tiny portion of the washing and ironing money to mail it. Then, of course, she would take the Watschen, most likely in the kitchen, and she would not make a sound. 3 days later, the plan came to fruition.
"Some of it's missing."
Mama counted the money a fourth time with Liesl over at the stove. It was warm there, and it cooked the fast flow of her blood.
"What happened, Liesl?"
She lied.
"They must have given me less than usual."
"Did you count it?"
She broke.
"I spent it, Mama."
Rosa came closer. This was not a good sign. She was very close to the wooden spoons.
"You what?"
Before she could answer, the wooden spoon came down on Liesl Memminger's body like the gate of God, red marks like footprints, and they burned. From the floor, when it was over, the girl actually looked up and explained. There was pulse and yellow light all together. Her eyes blinked.
"I mailed my letters."
What came to her then was the dustiness of the floor, the feeling that her clothes were more next to her than on her, and the sudden realization that this would all be for nothing, that her mother would never write back, and she would never see her again. The reality of this gave her a second Watschen. It stung her, and it did not stop for many minutes. Above her, Rosa appeared to be smudged, but she soon clarified as her cardboard face loomed closer. Dejected, she stood there in all her plumpness, holding the wooden spoon at her side like a club. She reached down and leaked a little.
"I'm sorry, Liesl."
Liesl knew her well enough to understand that it was not for the hiding. The red marks grew larger in patches on her skin as she lay there, in the dust and the dirt and the dim light. Her breathing calmed, and a stray yellow tear trickled down her face. She could feel herself against the floor, a forearm, a knee, an elbow, a cheek, a calf muscle. The floor was cold, especially against her cheek, but she was unable to move. She would never see her mother again. For nearly an hour she remained, spread out under the kitchen table, till Papa came home and played the accordion. Only then did she sit up and start to recover. When she wrote about that night, She held no animosity toward Rosa Huberman at all, or toward her mother for that matter. To her, they were only victims of circumstance. The only thought that continually recurred was the yellow tear. Had it been dark, she realized, that tear would have been black. But it was dark, she told herself. No matter how many times she tried to imagine that scene with the yellow light that she knew had been there, she had to struggle to visualize it. She was beaten in the dark, and she had remained there on a cold, dark kitchen floor. Even Papa's music was the color of darkness. Even Papa's music. The strange thing was that she was vaguely comforted by that thought, rather than distressed by it. The dark, the light, what was the difference? Nightmares had reinforced themselves in each, as the book thief began to truly understand how things were and how they would always be. If nothing else, she could prepare herself. Perhaps that's why on the Führer's birthday, when the answer to the question of her mother's suffering showed itself completely, she was able to react, despite her perplexity and her rage. Liesl Memminger was ready. Happy birthday, Herr Hitler. Many happy returns. Hitler's birthday, 1940. Against all hopelessness, Liesl still checked the mailbox each afternoon throughout March and well into April. This was despite a Hans-requested visit from Frau Heinrich, who explained to the Hubermans that the foster care office had lost contact completely with Paula Memminger. Still, the girl persisted, and as you might expect, each day, when she searched the mail, there was nothing. Molking, like the rest of Germany, was in the grip of preparing for Hitler's birthday. This particular year, with the development of the war and Hitler's current victorious position, the Nazi partisans of Molking wanted the celebration to be especially befitting. There would be a parade, marching, music, singing. There would be a fire. While Liesl walked the streets of Molking, picking up and delivering washing and ironing, Nazi party members were accumulating fuel. A couple of times, Liesl was a witness to men and women knocking on doors, asking people if they had any material that they felt should be done away with or destroyed. Papa's copy of the Molking Express announced that there would be a celebratory fire in the town square, which would be attended by all local Hitler Youth divisions. It would commemorate not only the Führer's birthday, but the victory over his enemies and over the restraints that had held Germany back since the end of World War I. Any materials, it requested, from such times, newspapers, posters, books, flags, and any found propaganda of our enemies, should be brought forward to the Nazi Party office on Munich Street. Even Schillerstrasse, the Road of Yellow Stars, which was still awaiting its renovation, was ransacked one last time to find something, anything, to burn in the name of the Führer's glory. It would have come as no surprise if certain members of the party had gone away and published 1,000 or so books or posters of poisonous moral matter simply to incinerate them. Everything was in place to make April the 20th magnificent. It would be a day full of burning and cheering. And book thievery. In the Huberman household that morning, all was typical. "That Saukerl's looking out the window again," cursed Rosa Huberman. "Every day," she went on. "What are you looking at this time?" "Oh," moaned Papa with delight. The flag cloaked his back from the top of the window. "You should have a look at this woman I can see." He glanced over his shoulder and grinned at Liesl. "I might just go and run after her. She leaves you for dead, Mama." "Schwein!" She shook the wooden spoon at him. Papa continued looking out the window at an imaginary woman and a very real corridor of German flags. On the streets of Molking that day, each window was decorated for the Führer. In some places, like Frau Diller's, the glass was vigorously washed, and the swastika looked like a jewel on a red and white blanket. In others, the flag trundled from the ledge like washing hung out to dry. But it was there. Earlier, there had been a minor calamity. The Hubermans couldn't find their flag.
"They'll come for us," Mama warned her husband. "They'll come and take us away."
They.
"We have to find it."
At one point, it seemed like Papa might have to go down to the basement and paint a flag on one of his drop sheets. Thankfully, it turned up, buried behind the accordion in the cupboard.
"That infernal accordion, it was blocking my view," Mama swiveled. "Liesl?"
The girl had the honor of pinning the flag to the window frame. Hans Jr. and Trudy came home for the afternoon eating, like they did at Christmas or Easter. Now seems like a good time to introduce them a little more comprehensively. Hans Jr. had the eyes of his father and the height. The silver in his eyes, however, wasn't warm like Papa's. They'd been furred. There was more flesh on his bones, too, and he had prickly blonde hair and skin like off-white paint. Trudy, or Trudel, as she was often known, was only a few inches taller than Mama. She had cloned Rosa Huberman's unfortunate waddlesome walking style, but the rest of her was much milder. Being a live-in housemaid in a wealthy part of Munich, she was most likely bored of children, but she was always capable of at least a few smiled words in Liesl's direction. She had soft lips, a quiet voice. They came home together on the train from Munich, and it didn't take long for old tensions to rise up. A short history of Hans Hubermann versus his son. The young man was a Nazi. His father was not. In the opinion of Hans Jr., his father was part of an old, decrepit Germany, one that allowed everyone else to take it for the proverbial ride while its own people suffered. As a teenager, he was aware that his father had been called Der Judenmaler, the Jew painter, for painting Jewish houses. Then came an incident I'll fully present to you soon enough, the day Hans blew it, on the verge of joining the party. Everyone knew you weren't supposed to paint over slurs written on a Jewish shop front. Such behavior was bad for Germany, and it was bad for the transgressor.
"So, have they let you in yet?"
Hans Jr. was picking up where they'd left off at Christmas.
"In what?"
"Take a guess. The party."
"No, I think they've forgotten about me."
"Well, have you even tried again? You can't just sit around waiting for the new world to take it with you. You have to go out and be part of it, despite your past mistakes."
Papa looked up. "Mistakes? I've made many mistakes in my life, but not joining the Nazi party isn't one of them. They still have my application, you know that, but I couldn't go back to ask. I just..."
That was when a great shiver arrived. It waltzed through the window with the draft. Perhaps it was the breeze of the Third Reich, gathering even greater strength. Or maybe it was just Europe, again, breathing. Either way, it fell across them as their metallic eyes clashed like tin cans in the kitchen.
"You've never cared about this country," said Hans Jr. "Not enough, anyway."
Papa's eyes started corroding. It did not stop Hans Jr. He looked now for some reason at the girl. With her three books standing upright on the table, as if in conversation, Liesl was silently mouthing the words as she read from one of them.
"And what trash is this girl reading? She should be reading Mein Kampf."
Liesl looked up.
"Don't worry, Liesl," Papa said. "Just keep reading. He doesn't know what he's saying."
But Hans Jr. wasn't finished. He stepped closer and said,
"You're either for the Führer or against him. And I can see that you're against him. You always have been."
Liesl watched Hans Jr. in the face, fixated on the thinness of his lips and the rocky line of his bottom teeth.
"It's pathetic how a man can stand by and do nothing as a whole nation cleans out the garbage and makes itself great."
Trudy and Mama sat silently, scaredly, as did Liesl. There was the smell of pea soup, something burning, and confrontation. They were all waiting for the next words. They came from the son. Just two of them.
"You coward."
He upturned them into Papa's face, and he promptly left the kitchen and the house.
Ignoring futility, Papa walked to the doorway and called out to his son,
"Coward! I'm the coward!"
He then rushed to the gate and ran pleadingly after him. Mama hurried to the window, ripped away the flag, and opened up. She, Trudy, and Liesl all crowded together, watching a father catch up to his son and grab hold of him, begging him to stop. They could hear nothing, but the manner in which Hans Jr. shrugged loose was loud enough. The sight of Papa watching him walk away roared at them from up the street.
"Hansi!"
Mama finally cried out. Both Trudy and Liesl flinched from her voice.
"Come back!"
The boy was gone. Yes, the boy was gone, and I wish I could tell you that everything worked out for the younger Hans Huberman, but it didn't. When he vanished from Himmel Street that day in the name of the Führer, he would hurtle through the events of another story, each step leading tragically to Russia, to Stalingrad. Some facts about Stalingrad. 1. In 1942 and early 43, in that city, the sky was bleached bedsheet white each morning. 2. All day long, as I carried the cells across it, that sheet was splashed with blood, until it was full and bulging to the earth. 3. In the evening, it would be wrung out and bleached again, ready for the next dawn. 4. And that was when the fighting was only during the day. With his son gone, Hans Huberman stood for a few moments longer. The street looked so big. When he reappeared inside, Mama fixed her gaze on him, but no words were exchanged. She didn't admonish him at all, which, as you know, was highly unusual. Perhaps she decided he was injured enough, having been labelled a coward by his only son. For a while, he remained silently at the table after the eating was finished. Was he really a coward, as his son had so brutally pointed out? Certainly, in World War I, he considered himself one. He attributed his survival to it. But then, is there cowardice in the acknowledgement of fear? Is there cowardice in being glad that you lived? His thoughts crisscrossed the table as he stared into it.
"Papa," Liesl asked, but he did not look at her. "What was he talking about? What did he mean when—"
"Nothing," Papa answered. He spoke quiet and calm to the table. "It's nothing. Forget about him, Liesl." It took perhaps a minute for him to speak again. "Shouldn't you be getting ready?" He looked at her this time. "Don't you have a bonfire to go to?"
"Yes, Papa."
The book thief went and changed into her Hitler Youth uniform, and half an hour later they left, walking to the BDM headquarters. From there, the children would be taken to the town square in their groups. Speeches would be made. A fire would be lit. A book would be stolen. 100% pure German sweat. People lined the streets as the youth of Germany marched toward the town hall and the square. On quite a few occasions, Liesl forgot about her mother and any other problem of which she currently held ownership. There was a swell in her chest as the people clapped them on. Some kids waved to their parents, but only briefly. It was an explicit instruction that they march straight and don't look or wave to the crowd. When Rudy's group came into the square and was instructed to halt, there was a discrepancy. Tommy Müller. The rest of the regiment stopped marching, and Tommy ploughed directly into the boy in front of him.
"Dummkopf!"
the boy spat before turning around.
"I'm sorry,"
said Tommy, arms held apologetically out. His face tripped over itself.
"I couldn't hear."
It was only a small moment, but it was also a preview of troubles to come. For Tommy. For Rudy. At the end of the marching, the Hitler Youth divisions were allowed to disperse. It would have been near impossible to keep them all together, as the bonfire burned in their eyes and excited them. Together they cried one united, "Heil Hitler!" and were free to wander. Liesl looked for Rudy, but once the crowd of children scattered, she was caught inside a mess of uniforms and high-pitched words, kids calling out to other kids. By 4:30, the air had cooled considerably.
People joked that they needed warming up. That's all this trash is good for anyway.
Carts were used to wheel it all in. It was dumped in the middle of the town square and doused with something sweet. Books and paper and other material would slide or tumble down, only to be thrown back onto the pile. From further away, it looked like something volcanic, or something grotesque and alien that had somehow landed miraculously in the middle of town and needed to be snuffed out, and fast. The applied smell leaned toward the crowd, who were kept at a good distance. There were well in excess of 1,000 people, on the ground, on the town hall steps, on the rooftops that surrounded the square. When Liesl tried to make her way through, a crackling sound prompted her to think that the fire had already begun. It hadn't. The sound was kinetic humans, flowing, charging up. "They've started without me." Although something inside told her that this was a crime, after all, her three books were the most precious items she owned, she was compelled to see the thing lit. She couldn't help it. I guess humans like to watch a little destruction. Sand castles, houses of cards, that's where they begin. Their great skill is their capacity to escalate. The thought of missing it was eased when she found a gap in the bodies and was able to see the mound of guilt, still intact. It was prodded and splashed, even spat on. It reminded her of an unpopular child, forlorn and bewildered, powerless to alter its fate. No one liked it. Head down, hands in pockets, forever. Amen. Bits and pieces continued falling to its sides as Liesl hunted for Rudy. Where is that Saukerl? When she looked up, the sky was crouching. A horizon of Nazi flags and uniforms rose upward, crippling her view every time she attempted to see over a smaller child's head. It was pointless. The crowd was itself. There was no swaying it, squeezing through, or reasoning with it. You breathed with it, and you sang its songs. You waited for its fire. Silence was requested by a man on a podium. His uniform was shiny brown. The iron was practically still on it. The silence began. His first words,
"Heil Hitler!"
His first action, the salute to the Führer.
"Today is a beautiful day," he continued. "Not only is it our great leader's birthday, but we also stop our enemies once again. We stop them reaching into our minds."
Liesl still attempted to fight her way through.
"We put an end to the disease that has been spread through Germany for the last 20 years, if not more."
He was performing now what is called a Schreierei, a consummate exhibition of passionate shouting, warning the crowd to be watchful, to be vigilant, to seek out and destroy the evil machinations plotting to infect the motherland with its deplorable ways.
"The immoral, the communisten."
That word again, that old word, dark rooms, suit-wearing men,
"die Juden, the Jews."
Halfway through the speech, Liesl surrendered. As the word communist seized her, the remainder of the Nazi recital swept by either side, lost somewhere in the German feet around her. Waterfalls of words. A girl treading water, she thought it again. Kommunisten. Up until now, at the BDM, they had been told that Germany was the superior race, but no one else in particular had been mentioned. Of course, everyone knew about the Jews, as they were the main offender in regard to violating the German ideal. Not once, however, had the communists been mentioned until today, regardless of the fact that people of such political creed were also to be punished. She had to get out. In front of her, a head with parted blonde hair and pigtails sat absolutely still on its shoulders. Staring into it, Liesl revisited those dark rooms of her past and her mother answering questions made up of one word. She saw it all so clearly. Her starving mother, her missing father, Kommunisten, her dead brother.
And now we say goodbye to this trash, this poison.
Just before Liesel Memminger pivoted with nausea to exit the crowd, the shiny, brown-shirted creature walked from the podium. He received a torch from an accomplice and lit the mound, which dwarfed him in all its culpability.
Heil Hitler!
The audience.
Heil Hitler!
A collection of men walked from a platform and surrounded the heap, igniting it, much to the approval of everyone. Voices climbed over shoulders, and the smell of pure German sweat struggled at first, then poured out. It rounded corner after corner, till they were all swimming in it, the words, the sweat, and smiling. Let's not forget the smiling. Many jocular comments followed, as did another onslaught of Heil Hitlering.
You know, it actually makes me wonder if anyone ever lost an eye or injured a hand or wrist with all of that. You'd only need to be facing the wrong way at the wrong time, or stand marginally too close to another person. Perhaps people did get injured. Personally, I can only tell you that no one died from it, or at least not physically.
There was, of course, the matter of 40 million people I picked up by the time the whole thing was finished, but that's getting all metaphoric. Allow me to return us to the fire. The orange flames waved at the crowd as paper and print dissolved inside them. Burning words were torn from their sentences. On the other side, beyond the blurry heat, it was possible to see the brown shirts and swastikas joining hands. You didn't see people, only uniforms and signs. Birds above did laps. They circled, somehow attracted to the glow, until they came too close to the heat. Or was it the humans? Certainly, the heat was nothing. In her attempt to escape, a voice found her.
Liesel!
It made its way through, and she recognized it. It was not Rudy, but she knew that voice. She twisted free and found the face attached to it. Oh, no. Ludwig Schmeichel. He did not, as she expected, sneer or joke or make any conversation at all. All he was able to do was pull her toward him and motion to his ankle. It had been crushed among the excitement and was bleeding dark and ominous through his sock. His face wore a helpless expression beneath his tangled blonde hair. An animal. Not a deer in lights, nothing so typical or specific. He was just an animal. Hurt among the melee of its own kind, soon to be trampled by it. Somehow she helped him up and dragged him toward the back. Fresh air. They staggered to the steps at the side of the church. There was some room there, and they rested, both relieved. Breath collapsed from Schmeichel's mouth. It slipped down over his throat. He managed to speak. Sitting down, he held his ankle and found Liesel Memminger's face. Thanks. He said, to her mouth rather than her eyes. More slabs of breath, and... They both watched images of schoolyard antics, followed by a schoolyard beating.
I'm sorry for... you know.
Liesel heard it again. Kommunisten. She chose, however, to focus on Ludwig Schmeichel.
Me too.
They both concentrated on breathing then, for there was nothing more to do or say. Their business had come to an end. The blood enlarged on Ludwig Schmeichel's ankle. A single word leaned against the girl. To their left, flames and burning books were cheered like heroes. The Gates of Thievery. She remained on the steps, waiting for Papa, watching the stray ash and the corpse of collected books. Everything was sad. Orange and red embers looked like rejected candy, and most of the crowd had vanished. She'd seen Frau Diller leave, very satisfied, and Pfiffikus, white hair, a Nazi uniform, the same dilapidated shoes, and a triumphant whistle. Now there was nothing but cleaning up, and soon no one would even imagine it had happened. But you could smell it.
What are you doing?
Hans Hubermann arrived at the church steps.
Hi, Papa.
You were supposed to be in front of the town hall.
Sorry, Papa.
He sat down next to her, halving his tallness on the concrete and taking a piece of Liesl's hair. His fingers adjusted it gently behind her ear. "Liesl, what's wrong?" For a while, she said nothing. She was making calculations, despite already knowing. An 11-year-old girl is many things, but she is not stupid. A small addition. The word communist, plus a large bonfire, plus a collection of dead letters, plus the suffering of her mother, plus the death of her brother, equals the Führer. The Führer. He was the they that Hans and Rosa Huberman were talking about that evening when she first wrote to her mother. She knew it, but she had to ask. "Is my mother a communist?" Staring straight ahead. "They were always asking her things before I came here." Hans edged forward a little, forming the beginnings of a lie. "I have no idea. I never met her." "Did the Führer take her away?" The question surprised them both, and it forced Papa to stand up. He looked at the brown-shirted men taking to the pile of ash with shovels. He could hear them hacking into it. Another lie was growing in his mouth, but he found it impossible to let it out. He said, "I think he might have, yes."
"I knew it!"
The words were thrown at the steps, and Liesl could feel the slush of anger stirring hotly in her stomach.
"I hate the Führer," she said. "I hate him!"
And Hans Huberman? What did he do? What did he say? Did he bend down and embrace his foster daughter as he wanted to? Did he tell her that he was sorry for what was happening to her mother, for what had happened to her brother? Not exactly. He clenched his eyes, then opened them. He slapped Liesl Memminger squarely in the face. "Don't ever say that." His voice was quiet but sharp. As the girl shook and sagged on the steps, he sat next to her and held his face in his hands. It would be easy to say that he was just a tall man sitting poor postured and shattered on some church steps, but he wasn't. At the time, Liesl had no idea that her foster father, Hans Huberman, was contemplating one of the most dangerous dilemmas a German citizen could face. Not only that, he'd been facing it for close to a year.
"Papa?"
The surprise in her voice rushed her, but it also rendered her useless. She wanted to run, but she couldn't. She could take a Watschen from nuns and Rosas, but it hurt so much more from Papa. The hands were gone from Papa's face now, and he found the resolve to speak again. "You can say that in our house," he said, looking gravely at Liesl's cheek, "but you never say it on the street, at school, at the BDM, never." He stood in front of her and lifted her by the triceps. He shook her. "Do you hear me?" With her eyes trapped wide open, Liesl nodded her compliance. It was in fact a rehearsal for a future lecture, when all of Hans Huberman's worst fears arrived on Himmel Street later that year, in the early hours of a November morning. "Good." He placed her back down. "Now, let us try." At the bottom of the steps, Papa stood erect and cocked his arm, 45 degrees. "Heil Hitler!" Liesl stood up and also raised her arm. With absolute misery, she repeated it. "Heil Hitler!" It was quite a sight. An 11-year-old girl, trying not to cry on the church steps, saluting the Führer as the voices over Papa's shoulder chopped and beat at the dark shape in the background. "Are we still friends?" Perhaps a quarter of an hour later, Papa held a cigarette olive branch in his palm, the paper and tobacco he'd just received. Without a word, Liesl reached gloomily across and proceeded to roll it. For quite a while they sat there together. Smoke climbed over Papa's shoulder. After another 10 minutes, the gates of thievery would open just a crack, and Liesl Memminger would widen them a little further and squeeze through. Two questions. Would the gates shut behind her? or would they have the goodwill to let her back out? As Liesl would discover, a good thief requires many things. Stealth, nerve, speed. More important than any of those things, however, was one final requirement.